Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Traumatic brain injury has been the topic of conversation a lot lately, especially in terms of war-related injuries and some sports injuries. Now, a study of whether hormone therapy can help is coming to Columbus. Joining us now to talk about that is Dr. Michelle Torbay. He's the director of the Cerebrovascular and Neurocritical Care Division at the Wexner Medical Center, where he is heading this new trial. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Also with us is Leonard Basobas. He is the clinical research manager for the trial. Welcome, Leonard.
Good morning.
So one of the tricky things about this trial is how you get your participants, right? Tell us how that works.
So for this particular trial, it's obviously aimed toward acute traumatic brain injury. Unfortunately, patients or individual don't plan to have a traumatic brain injury. It's something that happened very quickly, unbeknown to families, and you could be really even out of town when this situation happens. So usually EMS bring these patients to the emergency department, and that's how we're able to identify these patients and recruit them for the study.
And the time is of the essence. It's not, again, not that sort of thing where you can be diagnosed with hepatitis A and over time start getting treatments or whatever, however it's going to be dealt with. It's not going to immediately get do any harm to not do anything at that point. That's not the case with this.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, we don't really have the time, that other studies have. In any treatment regarding brain injury, time of essence. And we have a short amount of time where we need to infuse the drug in order to get the benefit out of it. And that's why we have the first 3 hours that are important to get the drug in. For this particular study, we're trying to do something new that hasn't been done in any study where, have a different way of obtaining consent to be enrolled.
So, Leonard, how does that work?
So, yes, we'll be enrolling people through the exception from informed consent. Now, it's a part of the federal regulations that we're actually allowed to do this. But in order for us to accomplish this goal, we need activities, frankly, like this, this radio spot. Also, some public disclosure, other public disclosure and community consultation activities that will allow us, again, to inform the community that we will actually be enrolling within an hour of the time frame from when you actually hit the emergency department door. We'll be looking to start treatment within that hour time frame.
And then the way it works is when you get a hold of family, next of kin, that kind of a thing, then they opt out or they agree to continue.
Correct. Actually, throughout these activities, the community consultation activities, you have an opportunity there at that point in time to actually opt out. There is a national opt-out registry, which we can direct everyone to, because essentially right now, because of the time frame of which, we need to administer the drug, I mean, everyone is essentially a volunteer at this point in time. So, you can feel free to contact us and actually go to that website and opt out. That's
okay. Well, we'll post that website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. This is really different. This isn't just about a therapy where you await and see therapy. This is something where you're administering something, and it's a hormone. And it's not just any hormone. We're talking about progesterone, which is usually associated with reproduction in women. Dr. Michelle Torbay, can you tell us about how this came about and what you're looking for?
Well, obviously, when there is a traumatic brain injury, there is a lot of processes that happen in the brain. Among those is potentially some neuroinflammation and neuronal death. And we found from animal studies, the research group at Emory looked into this, and they found that when they gave the rats progesterone after traumatic brain injury, those rats actually did very well. And so I went after that to a phase one trial where they looked into the safety of the drug in a small number of patients. And once the drug was stable, then we've moved now to full clinical trials. The trial has been going on already for 2 years in other part of the countries, and there hasn't been any major side effects that has been reported by the Data Safety Monitoring Board. And I think this is actually an amazing discovery so far, given the fact that this is a normal hormones and we're able to use it in such a neuroprotective way and protect the brain. So we're looking forward to be part of the study and start enrolling patients.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614 614- 292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. How many people are involved in the trial across the country now?
Currently, there's about 36 sites that are enrolling, and so far we've had about 706 patients enrolled.
What would exclude somebody from participating in it?
So the major exclusion is obviously if they have known allergies to eggs, and if we know that, then that's great. Otherwise, it's the nature of their injury. If it's a devastated brain injury, when they present and their neurological exam is really bad, then those patients are excluded from the study. If they have major open surgical wound, then these patients are excluded from the study. Beyond that, really, any traumatic brain injury patient would be considered an adequate candidate for the study.
Could somebody with a bad concussion be considered a candidate? Is that what we're talking about?
It could be a bad concussion for sure, yes. So, you know, the extent of traumatic brain injury goes from the mild concussion to really severe concussion, and then you get into really losing consciousness and really having a significant brain injury. So bad concussion could certainly be part of the study if they meet all the other inclusion criteria.
And how do you administer the progesterone? How is it introduced?
It's an intravenous medication that's given through the veins. Usually most patients will have an intravenous catheter placed as part of their care when they come to the emergency department. And it's like any other drugs that we usually give in the emergency department.
When in the animal testing, what did they see that suggested it was helpful?
That's a very good question, Ann. And so what we looked at in the animals, we looked at the brain itself, we looked at the tissue, we looked at the neurons, we looked at the cells. So at one side, they saw that these cells were actually recovered from the injury. They have actually did much better than the rats who did not receive the drugs. They also looked at the behavior of these drugs. We have behavioral testing that we do in the lab that sort of mimics some of what we do on a day-to-day basis. And they've seen that these rats actually behaved almost like normal rats after receiving the drugs.
We're used to thinking that the brain, the problem with brain injury is that it can't be repaired in so much as it can't regenerate. You know, you can't grow a new fin, you can't grow a new brain. Does that have something to do with this? Are we learning something different about it if there's the right hormone? Or is recovery and behavior not necessarily the same thing as regeneration?
You're right. Regeneration is different. And because the brain doesn't regenerate, it's very important to protect the parts of the brain that are not completely damaged, that are still in a state of shock. They haven't decided whether this cell is going to die or going to survive. And drugs like progesterone will help the cells move into this sort of healthy environment, and they could certainly continue to survive rather than going down the path of dying and basically causing neuronal injury.
Once again, the number is 614-292-8513. I'm talking to Leonard Basobas. He's clinical research manager for the Wexner Medical Center at OSU. We're talking about a new trial at OSU. And we're also talking with Dr. Michelle Torbe. He's director of a cerebrovascular and neurocritical care division at the Wexner Medical Center. We're talking with both of them about this. If you have a question or comment, you certainly are welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513. Is progesterone the only hormone that you're working with at this point?
For this specific trial, it is, Ann.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's been going on for about 2 years. You said there's about 800 people involved so far. Is any of this, are any of the trials located at the places where a lot of traumatic brain injuries are occurring right now, which is in Afghanistan?
Certainly none of these trials are at, you know, outside of the United States at this level, and certainly at the military field. But results like these studies, once they're done, could certainly be of great benefit to our military, because really, as you know, we do not have any established treatment for traumatic brain injury. And I think this would be of great importance for us, you know, at the national level.
Do you have a sense about how quickly you need to administer it, or you have a protocol that you're following at this point, but is there any sense that, are you learning anything about, you could wait some time, and are you expecting that people are going to be calling up saying, I had a traumatic brain injury, or my daughter did, or whoever, 6 months ago, can she be helped by this?
Sure, and honestly, as Dr. Torbay mentioned earlier, I mean, time is of the essence in this type of injury. So we're looking to administer, you know, again, as soon as possible. I mean, the optimum when they looked at the rats and early human studies was about 2 hours. But for this study, we're looking to administer drug within the first 4 hours from that site of injury and basically, hopefully, within an hour of once you hit the door.
And there's no, you're just not ready to expand and suggest that it could work after that because right. It's in the, where you are in the study.
Right. And there is, at least for now, there is no data to support that for a long term that there would be any benefit for now. And that's why we need to act quickly and try to protect the brain early on after injury.
An email from Mary Jo. She asks, is the progesterone dose adjusted to the weight of the patient? Leonard?
Yes. It actually is.
Are there any other adjustments you make depending on the participant?
Usually it's weight-based, and, you know, we assess the patient and we can daily sort of continue with the infusion based on that. In cases where the patient need to go for surgery, in those particular situations, we will stop the drug until they go through surgery and they come back, and we restart the drug after that.
Well, I asked about who could be excluded. Matt in Columbus, you want to ask about who can be included. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks, Anne. Fascinating topic. Yeah, so my question is, what are the inclusion criteria? Maybe to make it a little more simple, if you've had patients who've been included in the protocol, either at OSU or other sites, what is sort of a typical presenting injury? So you talked about concussions. What are some other sort of typical presenting injuries that would lead somebody to inclusion?
So really, thanks, Matt, for calling. Really, the most important is any patient with a traumatic brain injury when they present with what we call the Glasgow Coma Scale. This is sort of an assessment that is done for almost all traumatic brain injury. We're looking at mild, we're looking at moderate to severe traumatic brain injury. And so we look at this Glasgow Coma Scale. And basically, if the patient is between the range of, 4 all the way to 12, they're included in the study. So it could be a patient who fell on the ice and hit their head and they're a little bit confused. It could be a patient who was in a car accident. As long as they do not have open wounds in the brain where, you know, they really broke their skull and fractured their skull and there's brain coming out, most of these patients will be good candidates for the study.
Thank you, Matt. Go ahead, Leonard.
Oh, sure. And I need to make that distinction, too. I mean, as Dr. Torbay mentioned, I mean, it does have to be a closed head injury. He did mention a Glasgow scale. Also, two other very important inclusion criteria is that, you know, as far as age, we are looking at 18 or older. So we won't be enrolling, obviously, anybody below the age of 18. And also, we need to try to enroll, and again, major inclusion criteria as soon as possible. So we need that four-hour window.
Once again, can you tell people where they can go to learn more about this and learn more about what they need to know as far as the opt-out and so forth?
Sure. They can actually go to the national website, which is www.protect, or P-R-O-T-E-C-T, III.com. And on the left navigation bar, there's actually places to learn more about the study, some articles that have been recently published. But also, there's a link there to actually the opt-out registry. So if you do want to choose to opt out at this point in time, feel free to go to that website. Again, it's protectiii.com and follow the links.
Okay.
And when patients go, when they fill the opt-out registry, we will send them a bracelet that's an opt-out bracelet. This way, if they wear this bracelet and they were in a car accident and they do happen to come to our emergency room, then we know that they don't want to be in the study and they won't be recruited.
Is there a bracelet they can get if they want to be in the study?
That's a very good question, Annie. It's usually they've decided on a bracelet for opt-out, but that's something to really think about.
You know, particularly for people who you know, or hockey players or something like that,
sure.
Football players. But anyways, well, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. It's really interesting. Leonard Basobas, he's clinical research manager for the Wexner Medical Center at OSU, and also Dr. Michel Torbe, he is the director of Cerebrovascular and Neurocritical Care Division at Wexner as well. Thanks for listening. We'll return in a minute. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and sustaining givers are the future of our station. A sustainer gives a fixed amount each month. For example, $5, $10, or even $20 per month can be charged to your credit card. Then your membership is always active, and your member card renews automatically. Visit wosu.org/sustainer and sign up today. Expect cloudy skies and a slight chance of snow, a high of 27. A chance of some flurries tonight, a low of 17 degrees. Mostly sunny for Thursday with a high of 29, and then some freezing rain Thursday night with a low of 27. And that freezing rain will continue till Friday morning. Support comes from the McCoy Center. Pinkalicious likes pink cupcakes, but they're making her skin turn pink. She solves her dilemma in the musical Pinkalicious, based on the popular children's book, Sunday, February 24th at 1 and 4 p.m. at the McCoy Center in New Albany. Details at mccoycenter.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, someone sent me one of those online coupons for dental work that included 3D x-rays. And I never use those coupons because that would require forethought and planning. But I did stop and wonder about 3D x-rays. I'd never heard of them. So figured it was time to catch up on the technology of dentistry. It's not your mother's dentist office, apparently, anymore. Joining us now to talk about that is Dr. Patrick Lloyd. He's dean of the School of Dentistry at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Am I really behind the times when it comes to 3Ds? Are they for everyone or anyone?
Well, we have multiple 3D applications. Radiography is one of them, but we're revolutionized. The profession is revolutionized by digital technology of all sorts. From the moment our students start to learn to be a dentist to the day that they see their first patient through their 30 years of practice, digital technology has allowed us to do some things we hadn't been able to do before, enhance some procedures and learn more quickly about what patients' needs are. And 3D radiographs, x-rays are one of the new technologies.
It made me think, what about 3D printers? You could 3D print a tooth out first before spending a lot of money making it with all the ingredients you use to make them.
Well, we are able to scan now instead of making impressions in some cases electronically or optically scan a tooth that's been prepared for a crown or a cap.
Mm-hmm.
And using advanced computer machining, we can mill them to an amazing level of precision of fit and how they relate to adjacent teeth quickly and in a way that I used to dream about when I was a student many years ago. So the history is remarkable.
Was there a particular turning point for you in the profession where you know, here you're dean of the OSU School of Dentistry. Was there a time 10 years ago where you're like, wow, I mean, or was it 20 years ago and the rest of us are just catching up as consumers?
Well, there were people out in front of the cause when I was a student 30 years ago, and we were just marveled that maybe someday we can have this technology, and maybe someday we won't have to do all this, and maybe someday patients will be able to come and get their care more easily, and maybe someday, and so we're here. And I first started seeing it maybe 2.5 decades ago when people were looking at other ways of capitalizing on information and collecting it and managing it in a way we hadn't done before.
My guest is Patrick Lloyd. He's the dean of the School of Dentistry at Ohio State University. We're talking about technological advances in dentistry. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Are these advances really useful? I mean, do they really make a big difference when it comes to the average dental patient?
Well, I think in some cases they make it easier or more predictable or enhance our capacity to make diagnoses. they're not for every patient. You know, we've got practices all over the country that use technology that I used when I was a student or even from a decade and a half ago. But some of the enhancements allow us to identify things earlier. Some of them allow us to measure things more accurately. Some of them improve our efficiencies. For particular patient groups, they work extremely well. Our cone beam technology, for instance, allows us to go in and make three-dimensional views underneath the flesh, looking to see where wisdom teeth might be sitting or whether or not the lower jaw is growing quicker on the right side than the left side. And we can make these images and remove all the flesh and the muscles and look to see exactly what the skeleton looks like.
You can digitally remove them that way.
Just clean it off, and you've got just this naked bone right there, and you can see where the parts are. And the surgeon then has a greater appreciation. We've been able to cut the time down in some of the procedures by seeing this in advance. Implant placement. We couldn't put implants in some places if we didn't know three-dimensionally before we got in there where the vital structures were, where the sinus might be. So it affords us all sorts of insight for future planning, allows us to spend less time in the operating room. And
when you're talking about that, the 3D, what does the machine look like in my dentist's office that is taking a 3D picture of my tooth or my jaw or whatever? Is it one of those ones that goes all the way around my face? Yeah. Or is that different?
No, it looks similar to the pantomograph that would move around your head, but it captures a larger bank of data.
Okay.
The other devices we use, though, to capture three-dimensional information are as small as a wand or a toothbrush that can be inserted into your mouth and mystically scan your teeth before and after one is prepared for a crown to capture the shape and the sizes and how the gum tissue relates to the tooth. So there are all sorts of sizes depending on what you need to do and how big of a volume of information you're trying
and
to collect.
And it doesn't have to be very invasive.
No, that's the benefit for all of it. The patient can be almost unaware of what's going on, much more comfortable. It improves the experience for patients, especially when you use
there's
it.
There's a switch.
Oh, it's a big benefit to us. We're often known as a pain-inducing opportunity, and this allows us to mitigate some of that feeling that people have.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about technological advances in dentistry. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. Don't wait. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Does this all of this make dentistry more expensive? Because as we know, dentistry is a separate insurance coverage, and it is not going to be covered by the Healthcare Reform Act. So what does it mean in terms of what it'll cost?
I think over time it actually impacts on reducing some of the cost because we don't, as I said earlier, we don't spend as much time in some of the places where the patients are in the practice. So the benefit, less patient time occasionally, and a chance to pre-plan things in an advanced way. Another big benefit is because it's all digitalized, I can send it to the other side of the world and have someone look at it and give me their opinion. You know, how would you manage this? How might you do this different? Or you might find an unusual patient need, and there's only one person in San Francisco that does this really well. You can send that information there. You can discuss with him or her what their thoughts might be, so we can expedite interprofessional exchanges of information to plan these cases better, and that reduces costs. So I think there's a benefit here that we can use to capitalize on others' experiences and get the insight. You may be in a remote part of the state of Ohio, and you'd like one of our faculty to give you some advice on how you would deal with a patient's temporomandibular joint disorder, or whether or not their third molar is the problem that's causing them some other kind of discomfort, or treatment planning advice. So it affords our faculty and other knowledgeable people around the country to assist practitioners in making decisions, and that clearly is a cost-saving measure.
Is the system set up for that kind of collaboration yet?
It depends on the sophistication of your practice. You know, some practices are able to transfer that information and capitalize on it. Others are, you know, in the process of moving there. I've seen, you know, the last 15 years, last 10 years, where our practices are beginning to change. They're purchasing different equipment. They're capitalizing on some of these enhancements because it's their interest, their time, they're motivated. And we work real hard at OSU to try to expose our students to these experiences so that when they move into practices around Ohio or wherever they go, they feel comfortable. They're not intimidated by the technology. They see the benefits. They can weigh out whether this is good for the patient or whether they could have a more traditional approach to something. So we work real hard to expose them that experience is either at our college campus or at one of the 22 sites we send our students to around the state so that they can have a different exposure to a different kind of electronic health record or a different digital system. And so we believe we are graduating people who are prepared to adopt, when appropriate, this new technology.
Are dental assistants and the other people in the office getting the same kind of exposure?
They are, and they need to. It's part of the team approach so that you can let people practice at the top of their license and help you with collecting information or storing it or retrieving it. Everyone needs to appreciate where the information is collected, how it's managed, how it's retrieved, and how it's used.
So listeners out there, if you had some dental work done and it was horribly painful or invasive or something, you can give us a call and maybe Dr. Patrick Lloyd, he's dean of the School of Dentistry, can tell you how new technology may or may not help you. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're also using CAD/CAM technology. Now, I know CAD is computer-assisted design. What's the CAM part and how do they work together?
Yeah, computer-aided machining.
Okay.
So that you can design something on a computer. Let's say you need a new crown on one of your teeth. We can optically scan your tooth that's had the enamel and the dentin prepared so it can fit a crown. And then the dental technician or you yourself with the right kind of software can create this and design it on a computer screen, rotate it in three dimensions, and make sure the contacts are appropriate, the shape matches the adjacent teeth or what the tooth used to look like, then that is machined or prepared out of a block of material that then replaces the missing tooth structure. So you can grind at very precise levels so that it has all the shapes and the contours that fit where it had been your previous tooth, so the contacts and how it occludes with the opposing tooth. So it's a machining process at a very precise level. Very small amounts are removed in a very predictable way.
I know someone who's been through extensive occlusional adjustment where they're trying to get the bite right, and it went on for weeks. Does that have to happen anymore?
Well, there will always be patients who have multiple irregular contacts as their teeth meet. Some of them are driven by replacing biting surfaces. Some are the result of some trauma to the joint. Some of the result of eating habits or habits and how they hold a pen in their mouth. So there's all sorts of reasons why I think forevermore we're going to need to have some patients have their occlusion adjusted.
Which is the bite.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. In a very calculated way. It's not an indiscriminatory mowing down.
But can this technology help be more exacting about that?
Well, some of the technology that we have available now allows us to insert material in between the teeth and measure where the highest points are, where the greatest degree of force is being applied, where the force is on an inclined surface as opposed to a flat area, so we can discriminate where the forces are being applied, the degree of the force, and then using that along with our own clinical judgment, deciding where it is the most appropriate modification of a tooth surface needs to take place, so that when you're not only coming together vertically, but as you chew from right to left and back and forward, you've got an equal distribution of forces to make things comfortable and physiologically stable.
Mary in Cleveland, you're on the air. Welcome, Mary.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question would be just if there's some place that she could go to perhaps utilize this information where she could find out about this type of technology to greater serve the dental needs of her and others, I'm sure.
You said it's your friend who has denture problems.
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Lloyd, is this something that could be helpful for people who use dentures?
Well, it depends on what your denture problems are. If it's the result of some irregular shape of the jaw bones that are causing forces to be applied more acutely in some areas or the other, you know, we can use the technology to scan to see underneath the tissue if there's areas that need to be structurally modified or surgically adjusted or built up to provide better support. If the difficulty is the result of things like a dry mouth or that they don't quite as adapt as well as they used to, those are different problems that would require more clinical review by the practitioner to make some specific recommendations. Denture competence is the result of all sorts of things: fluid consistency, good neuromuscular coordination, a continued attention to oral hygiene, a very well-lubricated mouth, a diet selection that encourages good force distribution, and more often than not, capitalizing on implant procedures that can make sure that they're always where they need to be so that when you strike together to bite something, they're positioned properly and the load is distributed not just on the gum tissue but on the bone that holds them in place.
Thank you, Mary. To what extent, I mean, ultimately, we're often coached as consumers to get a second opinion when it comes to physicians. And with this kind of technology coming out now, it's in some places, it's not in some places, it's certainly not uniform yet. How do you recommend people go about deciding whether or not to get a second opinion when it comes to things like the dentures? Should she check with another, office? Should she go somewhere?
I think there's always value, especially when the recommendations are substantial, to make sure that what your chief complaint is will be taken care of by the treatment that the provider is recommending. I think there's always an advantage when two providers independently recommend the same thing. I think the patient feels much more confident. Even if the outcome isn't exactly what they wanted to have happen, if two independent providers recommend the same thing, then you adapt, you adjust, and you feel like you got what you needed. You received the kind of care that was appropriate for your needs. I think there's big psychological advantage to that.
And are the dentists that you're teaching, are they taught to expect that and appreciate that?
Well, I think they are. Oftentimes, patients will come to Ohio State's Dental College to get a second opinion.
Okay.
You know, I've often told patients this is the best place to go for a second opinion. I have no personal financial vested interest in you.
Mm-hmm.
I can offer you my professional advice of 35 years of practice and let you make a good decision based on my insight and perspective. So our students see patients that come in who've seen practitioners around the state and come to our college for a second opinion. And oftentimes we can bring around the patient three or four different kind of dental specialists who have different insights, the surgeons, the periodontist, the root canal specialist, the general practitioner. And all at once, the patient can get these different viewpoints, and that can add further yet to making an informed decision. That's the whole goal,
mm-hmm.
that you can make a decision that you believe is good for you. It takes advantage of your particular problem. It fits within your economic profile, and it's customized just for you. And I think those are big advantages, that second opinion.
Ultimately, particularly when it comes to dentistry, it is still one of those things that most of the problems you face are due to neglect, poor dental health, that kind of a thing, poor hygiene, not taking care of yourself properly in the first place, right?
That's right. Most of what we end up seeing is the result of just behaviors that are inconsistent with a lot of things that we know. But occasionally, patients are seeking our care who were born without teeth,
mm-hmm.
or people who have been in very difficult accidents, like the previous presenter, very difficult accidents that caused them to have trauma, and they developed that. But the vast majority are the result of habits like smoking, you know, not brushing their teeth regularly, having a diet that causes the enamel not to maintain its stability, or sometimes it's the consequence of medical therapy. If a drug mm-hmm. dries your mouth out and you find you're feeling better because when you eat candy, you know, it adds to the cycle of problems. So some of them are driven by the side effects of therapy from other providers. Some of them are behaviors that we haven't adopted well, and some are the consequences of things just happen to us.
Bob in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Bob.
Good morning. A quick question about materials used. It used to be we use amalgam and then a little bit of some form of acrylic or something like that. Have we got into regeneration of actual enamel yet? Is that possible?
Well, we haven't seen anyone develop replacement tissue for lost tooth surfaces. We've seen some experiments where people have generated an entire tooth from stem cell tissue, but we haven't seen any of it used yet to be implanted in tooth structure to replace parts that are either lost from disease or some other sort of consequence of fracture, et cetera. We do have physical materials now. Our composite resins are approaching some characteristics that are not too dissimilar from how it is enamel relates to itself. So when you strike them and chew against them, their wear coefficient is getting to be very close. How we bond them to natural tooth structure has created a seal that's nearly microscopically impervious to all sorts of things. So we're getting closer every year. In my years of practice now, again, I've seen these discoveries that I just used to dream about 30 years ago. That's just remarkable.
Well, thanks for sharing some of them with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure being with you.
Dr. Patrick Lloyd, he's Dean of the School of Dentistry at Ohio State University. Thanks for your calls. Coming up, we're going to turn our sights to exercise. Again, one of those seems simple, but it's not at all. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of an American military base in a remote region of Afghanistan, surrounded by mountains and insurgents. In one of the deadliest fights in Afghanistan, 53 Americans battled nearly 400 Taliban fighters. We talk with Jake Tapper about his new book, The Outpost. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon here on 89.7 NPR News. Join WOSU TV Thursday night to go inside the mind of a chef. This new program combines travel, cooking, history, science, and humor into an unforgettable journey. Executive producer and narrator Anthony Bourdain takes viewers inside the mind of noted chefs and restaurateurs. Watch The Mind of a Chef. It's Thursday night at 10 on WOSU TV. 19 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds today with a slight chance of snow, a high of 27. A few flurries for tonight, still cloudy skies, a low of 17 degrees. Some sunshine for Thursday, a high of 29, and then a chance of snow mixing with freezing rain Thursday night, a low of 27 degrees. Looking ahead to Friday, some freezing rain in the morning and a high of 42. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday. Most of us probably feel that we should be making more time to exercise every week, but a new study suggests that perhaps we shouldn't worry so much. Joining us now to discuss that and physical fitness in general is Gretchen Reynolds. She writes the Phys Ed column for the New York Times and is author of The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, and Live Longer. Welcome back to the program, Gretchen.
I'm delighted to be here.
And whenever Gretchen's on the program, I like to invite our listeners to call in with your exercise regimen or lack thereof. Maybe you want to figure out what'll work for you. Gretchen enjoys having you run your regimen by her, and she can comment on it. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to our Facebook page and post your thoughts there. So this new study suggests that we maybe don't need to work out as often. What were the researchers actually looking for in this study?
What they were looking for is this sort of holy grail of figuring out what is the right dose of exercise in order to make people healthier without sort of overstraining either their schedules or their bodies. And so what the researchers did was they gathered a group of older women, sedentary women, who hadn't been exercising at all for years. And they had them, they assigned them to three different groups. And one group exercised twice a week. They lifted weights once and they did an aerobic workout. They either jogged or, rode an exercise bike fairly easily at first, once a week. The second group did the same workout only four times a week. They lifted weights twice, did the endurance twice. And the final group exercised 6 days a week, which many people think you have to do in order to get benefits, that in order to get healthier, you have to work out almost every day. It turned out that was not the case. The group that got the most benefits in terms of getting more fit, getting healthier, reducing their blood pressure, losing some body fat, was the group that worked out four times a week. And in fact, what they did that the other groups did not was they started moving more all the time. They actually were burning more than 200 calories a day more in addition to what they burned during the exercise than they had been before they started working out.
Why was that?
Well, the researchers believe it's because they felt better, for one thing, The fact that they were exercising was helping them to lose some weight. It was improving their aerobic fitness. It was also improving their muscles, and they felt better.
So you mean like they felt like getting up and going for a bike ride?
Exactly.
Okay.
Or just walking more.
Mm-hmm.
They probably took the stairs instead of the elevator. They just had more energy. And interestingly, the group that worked out 6 days a week moved less during the rest of the day than they had been before they started exercising. They actually were burning fewer calories overall than they had been before they started exercising. And that's probably because they didn't have very much time. They were spending so much time exercising, mm-hmm. they started driving everywhere. They took the escalator instead of the stairs. They sat more. So they actually got less overall benefit than the people who worked out 4 times a week, and even than the people who worked out 2x a week.
Did this surprise you? You know, you look at these studies all the time.
It did surprise me, actually. And one of the things that really surprised me was that the people who exercised only 2x a week, they did 1 session of weight training and 1 session of aerobic exercise, got almost as fit, improved their fitness almost as much as the group that worked out 4 times a week and the group that worked out 6 times a week. So that small dose of exercise allowed people to get more fit, to lose body fat, to lose weight, and to feel better. And the group that did 4 times a week benefited so much more than the other groups. It really was pretty remarkable.
Why did you start, why were they working with older sedentary women?
Because that's a group, and similarly with many middle-aged and older men, too, they haven't been exercising. They feel that, A, they don't have time to start, and if they start, they have to do so much, it's not worth beginning at all. And this study clearly showed you can start with a small dose of exercise. These people were spending about 40 minutes in their exercise sessions. The group that was doing it 2x a week, that's 2 40-minute sessions a week. They gained so much in terms of their aerobic endurance and how much body fat they lost, how much better they felt. If you can start by doing 2 exercise sessions a week, and that's all, mm-hmm. it will make an enormous difference. If you can then add 2 more sessions and stop there, don't mm-hmm. do any more,
mm-hmm.
that will actually change your life. And this was oriented towards a group of people who frequently sort of have given up,
mm-hmm.
who feel that they're too old, they're too busy, they're too tired, it's not worth the effort. This study clearly showed it is worth the effort, and you don't have to put in a huge amount of effort.
The best news of all. David in Clintonville, welcome to the show. You want to share your favorite exercise regimen. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. Mm-hmm. Yes, I used to work as a personal trainer, and for a while I went around to all the different machines. I had a heart monitor, and I wanted to see which one would be able to get your heart rate up with the least amount of pain and agony and damage to joints and percussiveness and all that. And it turned out that the cross-country ski machine did the best job in terms of raising my heart rate to where I wanted to put it, you know, a target zone. And then later on, I found out that they did a study of Olympic athletes and found that the cross-country skiers were indeed the most aerobically fit of all the athletes, and they beat out marathon runners and these people that we normally think are, you know, very serious aerobically fit people. And I think the reason is you use your arms and your legs together, so you get more major muscle mass, you know, moving.
Mm-hmm.
And it just I find benefits of it are just tremendous. For instance, you can actually exercise on a cross-country ski machine even if you have a sprained ankle or a bad knee or a bad hip. I mean, you can limp on these machines. And really, I'm not kidding. You can limp on them and still get some benefit, quite a bit of benefit, actually.
Gretchen, have there been studies? What do we know about, what's it called, the real popular one?
The elliptical?
Well, the elliptical, but I'm thinking of the one where it is just like a cross-country machine.
Well, they're different manufacturers of the cross-country ski simulators. Mm-hmm. And the caller is right that when they've done studies of the endurance capacity of different types of athletes, cross-country skiers almost always win. They have enormous aerobic capacity because it's minute for minute, it requires more energy to do cross-country skiing than to do almost any other sport. And when they have done studies of the cross-country simulator machine, it's a pretty good representation of actual cross-country skiing. It doesn't require quite as much energy as being outside and fighting the wind and going up hills. But if you have a really limited period of time to work out, the caller is right. It's a very good way to get an upper body and a lower body workout in a concentrated period of time. Find it really hard to do, though.
Yeah, that's the one downside that I found was when I work with people, it's a thing that it isn't as natural as jogging or walking. People quite often quit very early. They find it's a balance problem. Especially if they've never cross-country skied before.
Well, it really goes to that core issue too, doesn't it, Gretchen?
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, it definitely works the core. Mm-hmm. It also appears to have actual neurological benefits because you have to maintain balance. You have to coordinate all your muscles more extensively than if, say, you're riding a bike or walking on the treadmill, which is good. But as the caller said, it really causes some people to quit because it is difficult. It doesn't feel right. And some people never do, in fact, do it well. And then they're not getting a good workout.
I grew up cross-country skiing. I would say the best thing to do is go take somebody 5 miles out in the woods, dump them.
You'll lose a friendship, but you'll make someone fitter.
And you have to get back, and you find it's actually easier to ski than it is to walk. So do that. But it is different doing the machine inside than it is cross-country skiing outdoors. Yeah, it's once you've, kissed the sun, it's kind of hard to go back. But thank you, David. That's a great call. I appreciate it. Take care. 614-292-8513. We have Gretchen Reynolds, exercise author and columnist for the New York Times, on the air right now. You want to share your exercise regimen? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Rod in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. Wanted to share my routine and also suggest that maybe people can work their routine in with things they normally would do otherwise. Basically, I live about 10 miles from work, and I bicycle to and from work, so that's about 20 miles a day. Do that 4 times a week. Plus, I do some other riding. So, like I said, maybe people might consider riding the bicycle to and from work, or doing errands, something like that.
Is that what you do?
That's what I do. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, just working it into your regular schedule, right, Gretchen?
Well, the healthiest country on earth is Holland, the Netherlands, where they have a very high percentage of the people actively commute, meaning they either ride their bike or they walk to school, to work, to appointments. When people do that, studies show they almost always are healthier. The problem is the built environment in the U.S. these days is not conducive to active commuting for a lot of people. Either there's too much traffic, there's a lot of pollution, there aren't good sidewalks to walk on.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't feel comfortable doing it. A lot of people haven't grown up riding in traffic. You do need to have some skills to effectively and safely ride in traffic, especially if there aren't bike lanes. Active commuting is a wonderful thing. I used to ride my bike to work every day when I worked in Chicago, and it was wonderful, but that's because I could ride along this huge bike path along the lakefront. No traffic, beautiful scenery, a wonderful, relaxing way to get to work. That's not true in a lot of places. And I think it's actually a social issue and definitely is worth writing to your local representative about. Put in bike lanes, put in sidewalks, promote kids walking to school. It would be a wonderful thing if there were more of that. But at the moment, it's quite difficult.
Thank you, Rod, for that call. Knees are something that bother a lot of people these days. It always sounds like it's all about me, doesn't it? You recommend good old-fashioned squats, which I liked hearing about, but some people worry that squats make it worse. Can you tell us, you know, why that's not the case?
We started a new feature in the Times called Ask Well, where people could write in with the questions about health. The single most popular question by far was a question about what you can do about aging knees. And so I talked to a couple of experts who agreed that one of the best things you can do, if you don't already have advanced arthritis, if you haven't had knee surgery, those are the caveats.
Okay.
If you fundamentally have a healthy knee that just sort of aches sometimes, squats are a really good way to stabilize the knee because they strengthen all of the muscles that control the knee, that hold it in place, which is the best way to keep it healthy. So if you do squats correctly, they are actually very good for the knee. If you do them wrong, they can hurt it. So I would recommend people get on YouTube, look up a video about how to correctly do squats, and there are lots of them, and they're mostly reliable, and then do 20 squats. It's very potent exercise, and it's quite hard.
It's very important to do them correctly.
It is important to do them correctly, and I can try and describe it, but it's much better. Look it up, find a good video, or mm-hmm. see a physical therapist, even a personal trainer. Mm-hmm. Have them show you how to do it correctly. Then you can do them when you're in your office, when you're on the phone. You can just throw in 5 squats, and you actually are really helping your knees.
We're just about out of time, but I wanted to bring up your column you wrote recently about the exercise groove. Sounds like a great idea, but you want to get out of your groove.
Yes, actually, what's really interesting is that the body tries so hard to find the easiest way for you to work out, the way that uses the least energy and therefore the least calories. That's what we're built for, is to be efficient, to not use a lot of energy. So you need to find ways, if you want to get more fit, if you want to burn calories, to get out of that groove a little bit, to make yourself work harder. One really good way is music. Set the music a little bit faster. Choose tunes that are a little bit faster than you would usually run or walk or bicycle.
Uh-huh.
It really will promote going a little bit harder.
Just want to push it.
Exactly.
Gretchen Reynolds, as always, it's a delight. Thank you so much for joining us again.
It's my great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Gretchen Reynolds is an exercise. She writes about exercise. She's written a book about exercise. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening today. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler, Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karim Shaban, Rose Joe, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.